Welcome back. Top of the third hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast this Thursday, February 20th, 2020. How many people even know who Catherine Casey was? How many people know what the Reese Committee was and what it was commissioned to investigate? Special Committee to Investigate Tax-Exempt Foundations. How many people are familiar with or have even read Catherine Casey's staff report number 4 as a result of House Resolution 217, published back in 1954? This information was conveniently digitized by Google. Her report, digitized originally from the University of Minnesota. And so, you know, where is the, there have been several books by the revisionist historians that Norman Dodd alluded to, several efforts to do exactly what Norman Dodd said, you know, the 100 most influential documents in our American history. We had these documents, and there was this idea of, you know, the Enlightenment and the rights of man and whatever, and now it's the rights of the collective. But it's a balanced effort. It's a communitarian effort. You know, again, whatever serves the bottom line, which actually serves to further foster hegemonic power and control. And that reminds me of James Corbett talking about the George Soros, the infamous Steve Croft 60 Minutes 1998 interview. He's just a nice guy, George Soros. I mean, he's just a great guy. So how many people are familiar with this information? How many people have looked into it? Where is the collection of the real, you know, the freedom documents that everyone has access to, and it's a high level, you know, you search anything, Google sends you to it, any search engine sends you to it. I'm being facetious, obviously. There is no such thing for obvious reasons. It is inimical to the interest of the Googles and the Palantirs and the Eric Schmidts and the Peter Thiels and so forth. When you really get down to it, one of the big problems with big tech and big data and so forth is that it really is sort of antithetical to personal freedom, individual liberty, autonomy, personal choice. This is why Apple says one button is all you need. It's the technocratic way. You go to the point of irreducible complexity, and then, you know what? Maybe we go a little further and we'll just tell you that's what you need. It's what you want. It's what you need. But I don't like it. It's uncomfortable. No, you like it. It's what you want. We'll just tell you. I want to get back to the Norman Dodd interview and just play a little excerpt of that, culminating in that exchange. How many people actually heard those recordings? Griffin asks. Norman Dodd responds, 3, maybe. 3, maybe. Myself, my top assistant, and Catherine. Wow, astounding. So without further ado, here is the excerpt from J. Edward Griffin's interview of Norman Dodd back in 1982. Go ahead, please.
Here for a second. At what point in your career did you become connected with the Reese Committee?
1953.
Yeah. And what was that capacity, sir?
That was the capacity of what they call Director of Research for the Reese Committee.
Can you tell us what the Reese Committee was attempting to do?
Yes, I can tell you. It was operating and carrying out instructions embodied in a resolution passed by the House of Representatives, which was to investigate the activities of foundations as to whether or not these activities could justifiably be labeled un-American without, I might say, defining what they meant by un-American. But that was the resolution, and the committee had then the task of selecting a council, and the council in turn had the task of selecting a staff, and he had to have somebody who would direct the work of that staff. And that was what they meant by the director of research.
What were some of the details, the specifics that you told the committee at that time?
Well, Mr. Griffin, in that report, I specifically, number one, defined what was, to us, what was meant by the phrase un-American. And we defined that in our way as being a determination to effect changes in the country by unconstitutional means. We have plenty of constitutional procedures, assuming that we wish to effect a change in the form of government or that sort of thing. And therefore, any effort in that direction which did not avail itself of the procedures which were authorized by the Constitution could be justifiably called un-American. That was the start of educating them up to that particular point. The next thing was to educate them as to the effect on the country as a whole of the activities of large endowed foundations over the then past 40 years.
What was that effect, sir?
That effect was to orient our educational system over away from support of the principles embodied in the Declaration of Independence and implemented in the Constitution, and educated them over to the idea that the task now was, as a result of the orientation of education to away from these briefly stated principles and self-evident truths. And that's what had been the effect of the wealth, which constituted the endowments of those foundations that had been in existence over the largest portion of the span of 50 years, and holding them responsible for this change. And what we were able to bring forward was that what we had uncovered was the determination of these large endowed foundations through their trustees to actually get control over the content of American education.
There's quite a bit of publicity given to your conversation with Rowan Gaither. Would you please tell us who he was and what was that conversation you had with him?
Rowan Gaither was at that time president of the Ford Foundation. And Mr. Gaither had sent for me when I found it convenient to be in New York, asked me to call upon him at his office, which I did. And on arrival, after a few amenities, Mr. Gaither said, "Mr. Dodd, we've asked you to come up here today because we thought that possibly, off the record, you would tell us why the Congress is interested in the activities of foundations such as ourselves." And before I could think of how I would reply to that statement, Mr. Gaither then went on voluntarily and stated, he said, "Mr. Dodd, all of us that have a hand in the making of policies here have had experience either with the OSS during the war or European Economic Administration after the war, we've had experience operating under directives. And these directives emanate, and did emanate, from the White House. Now we still operate under just such directives. Would you like to know what the substance of these directives is? I said, yes, Mr. Gaither, I'd like very much to know. Whereupon he made this statement to me, namely, Mr. Dodd, we here operate on similar, in response to similar directives, the substance of which is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Well, parenthetically, Mr. Griffin, I nearly fell off the chair. I, of course, it didn't, but my response to Mr. Gaither then was, well, Mr. Gaither, I can now answer your first question. You forced the Congress of the United States to spend $150,000 to find out what you just told me. So why don't you I said, of course, legally you're entitled to make grants for this purpose, but I don't think you're entitled to withhold that information from the people of the country to whom you're indebted for your tax exemption. So why don't you tell the people of the country that's what you've told me? And his answer was, we would not think of doing any such thing. So then I said, well, Mr. Gaither, obviously, you forced the Congress to spend this money in order to find out what you've just told me.
Mr. Dodd, you have spoken before about some interesting things that were discovered by Catherine Casey at the Carnegie Endowment. Can you tell us that story, please?
Yes, I'm glad to, Mr. Griffin. This experience that you have just referred to came about in response to a letter which I had written to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, asking certain questions and gathering certain information. And on the arrival of that letter, Dr. Johnson, who was then president of the Carnegie Endowment, telephoned me and said, did I ever come up to New York? And I said, yes, I did, more or less each weekend. And he said, well, when you're next here, will you drop in and see us? Which I did. And again, on arrival at the office of the endowment, I found myself in the presence of Dr. Joseph Johnson, the president, who was a successor to Alger Hiss. Two vice presidents and their own counsel, a partner in the firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And Dr. Johnson said, after, again, amenities, Mr. Dodd, we have your letter. We can answer all those questions, but it'd be a great deal of trouble. And we have a counter-suggestion. And our counter-suggestion is that if you can spare a member of your staff for 2 weeks and send that member up to New York, we will give to that member a room in the library and the minute books of this foundation since its inception. And we think that whatever you want to find out or the Congress wants to find out will be obvious from those minutes. Well, my first reaction was they'd lost their mind. I had a pretty good idea of what those minutes would contain. But I realized that Dr. Johnson had only been in office 2 years, and the vice presidents were relatively young men, and counsel seemed to be also a young man, and I guessed that probably they'd never read the minutes themselves. And so I said I had somebody, I would take it. I would accept their offer. And I went back to Washington, and I selected the member of my staff who was on my staff having been a practicing attorney in Washington, but she was on my staff to see to it that I didn't break any congressional procedures or rules. In addition to which, she was unsympathetic to the purpose of the investigation. She was level-headed and a very reasonably brilliant, capable lady. And her attitude toward the investigation was, what could possibly be wrong with foundations? They do so much good. Well, in the face of that sincere conviction of Catherine's, I went out of my way not to prejudice her in any way. But I did explain to her that she couldn't possibly cover 50 years of handwritten minutes in 2 weeks. So she would have to do what we call spot reading. And I blocked out certain periods of time to concentrate on. And off she went to New York. She came back at the end of 2 weeks with the following in the way of on dictaphone belts. We are now at the year 1908, which was the year that the Carnegie began operations. And in that year, the trustees, meeting for the first time, raise a specific question, which they discuss throughout the balance of the year in a very learned fashion. And the question is there any means known more effective than war, assuming you wish to alter the life of an entire people? And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909 they raise the second question and discuss it, namely, how do we involve the United States in a war? Well, I doubt at that time if there was any subject more removed from the thinking of most of the people of this country than its involvement in a war. There were intermittent shows in the Balkans, but I doubt very much if many people even knew where the Balkans were. Then finally, they answer that question as follows. We must control the State Department. And then that very naturally raises the question of how do we do that? And they answer it by saying, we must take over and control the diplomatic machinery of this country. And finally, they resolve to aim at that as an objective. Then time passes, and we are eventually in a war, which would have been World War I. And at that time, they record on their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. And finally, of course, the war is over. At that time, their interest shifts over to preventing what they call a reversion of life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914, when World War I broke out. And they arrive at that point, they come to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, we must control education in the United States. And they realize that that's a pretty big task. So it is too big for them alone, so they approach the Rockefeller Foundation with the suggestion that portion of education which could be considered domestic be handled by the Rockefeller Foundation, and that portion which is international should be handled by the endowment. And they then decide that the key to the success of these two operations lay in an alteration of the teaching of American history. So they approach four of the then most prominent teachers of American history in the country, people like Charles and Mary Byrd, and their suggestion to them is, will they alter the manner in which they present this subject, and they get turned down flat. So they then decide that it is necessary for them to do, as they say, build our own stable of historians. And then they approach the Guggenheim Foundation, which specializes in fellowships, and say, when we find young men in the process of studying for doctorates in the field of American history, and we feel that they are the right caliber, will you grant them fellowships on our say-so? And the answer is yes. So under that condition, eventually they assemble 20. And they take this 20 potential teachers of American history to London. And there they're briefed into what is expected of them when, as and if, they secure appointments in keeping with the doctorates they will have earned. And that group of 20 historians ultimately becomes the nucleus of the American Historical Association. And then toward the end of the 1920s, the endowment grants to the American Historical Association $400,000 for a study of our history in a manner which points to what can this country be, can it look forward to in the future. And that culminates in a 7-volume study, the last volume of which is, of course, in essence, a summary of the contents of the other 6. And the essence of the last volume is, the future of this country belongs to collectivism administered with characteristic American efficiency. That's the story that ultimately grew out of, and of course was what could have been presented by the members of this congressional committee to the Congress as a whole for just exactly what it said. But they never got to that point.
This is the story that emerged from the minutes of the Carnegie Fund.
That's right.
Carnegie Endowment.
That's
Fund.
Right.
And so...
It was official to that extent.
I see. And Catherine Casey brought all of these back in the form of dictated notes or verbatim readings of the minutes.
On dictaphone belts.
Are those in existence today?
I don't know. But if they are, they're somewhere in the archives under the control of the Congress, House of Representatives.
How many people actually heard those, or were they typed up transcripts made
of
them? How many people actually heard those recordings?
Oh, 3 maybe. Myself, my top assistants, and Catherine. Yeah, I might tell you this experience, as far as its impact on Catherine Casey was concerned, was she never was able to return to her law practice. If it hadn't been for Carol Reese's ability to tuck her away in a job with the Federal Trade Commission, I don't know what would have happened to Catherine. But ultimately, she lost her mind as a result of it. Terrible shock to her. It's a very rough experience to encounter proof of these kinds.
Somebody wrote a book back a while ago. I think the title, you know, Uncover Proofs of These Kind. There was a book titled Proofs of a Conspiracy, not singular, but plural. Proofs of a Conspiracy. Some kind of a book published, I think, back in the 18th century, late 18th century. Discovery of some, you know, secret notes or something like that, as I recall. Anyway, fascinating stuff. And do you see the coalescence? You know, Norman Dodd, you know, these folks admitting, I mean, Horace Rowan Gaither, you know, and I've talked about that family's involvement. You had the Grace Committee and, you know, generational old school bad guys, I would say, or, you know, the old money power elite contingent, as some might say. But, you know, Horace Rowan Gaither Jr. talking about the OSS, European Economic Administration. All of us have had a hand in making of policies here, have had experience either with the OSS during the war or the European Economic Administration after the war, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Dulles Brothers, again, Sullivan and Cromwell. And here is the, you know, the fusing together of these interests. There's the economic, there's the intelligence, admitted by Rowan Gaither. And, you know, for that matter, you have all of the peripheral characters in the story, including the Bush family, generational, Prescott, GHWB, GWB, etc., you know, right there. There is this, you know, that place where these folks operate in an entirely different strata, unrestricted, generally speaking. So far, you know, up, you know, it's like the visual, you know, 30,000 feet above the general public, so far removed that people just don't even recognize it. And if you try to say something to most people, nah, it's just dismissed. That's preposterous. How could you say such a thing? There are some excerpts from Catherine Casey's staff report number 4, you know, page 23, European influence, Prussian, French, English on the education system in particular. But, you know, in what Norman Dodd said, I mean, is it any wonder, just real quick before we go into a break, war, conflict, Balkanization, even mentions the Balkans as agents of change. And again, you start to look back into history, Alfred Mackinder, the geographic pivot of history, Brzezinski, you know, the conversations that they have at the Hoover Institution, Peter Robinson, Peter Thiel, other folks, you know. War, conflict, Balkanization as agents of change, like the vaccine to the reordering of DNA or the mimetic engineering of Lamarckian epigenetics and mind viruses. Is it any wonder then that, you know, we get these proliferating think tanks that talk about peace, like the Carnegie Endowment, but never seem to achieve it? Because what they're trying to do is turn the world upside down, and what they mean by peace, not necessarily what you and I mean by peace. We'll be right back.
Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. September 2018. Extendivite works in keeping my blood pressure in the normal range. I've been using Extendivite for many years now. May 2018. Great product. I use regularly and I rarely get sick. March 2018. This product has relieved what appeared to be angina pain in my chest and shortness of breath after climbing stairs. I'm quite happy about it. February 2018. My husband, son, and I have been using this product for a few months now, and we have noticed an improvement in our joints and blood pressure. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
How would you like to earn an extra $10,000 or more a month from the comfort of your home? We show you how to win with a home-based business opportunity. This could be one of the best financial decisions you ever make. Work from home, full-time or part-time. Plus, you'll never have to talk to anyone. Our professional sales team closes all your sales for you, and you keep 70% of all the sales made. You could be earning money while you're sleeping, shopping, working out, wherever you are, day or night. Our system goes to work for you. You can make a great income without any special computer skills or sales training. Plus, you get paid fast, within just 24 to 48 hours after our professional sales team closes a sale for you. Let us help you eliminate your financial concerns. You could be earning enough money to pay off debt, buy a house, a car, or whatever the case may be. We've got you covered. If you'd like to add an extra $10,000 or more a month to your portfolio, and you would like to know exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it, go now to www.getstartedwithus.com. That's www.getstartedwithus.com. Again, that's www.getstartedwithus.com.
Welcome back. Multitasking is bad for radio. Before there was Mike Pompeo, there were guys like Oliver North. We'll get to that in a second. So we'll go to the phones here in a second, but first, a brief excerpt from Michael Rupert's Crossing the Rubicon. Man, oh man, oh man. Now again, it's one of these, holy cow. He was so enthusiastic and full of vim and vigor. And then what happened? I'm telling you, I think, you know, so there's Palantir. There's, before that, there was The Promise. And what's the other one? Oh, I keep forgetting. Escapes my memory. It's again, Palantir Technologies. So just from the Wikipedia entry, customers under U.S. civil entities. Let's see, other clients as of 2019 include Polaris Project, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, of course. National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which I find a very very odd client, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It's very odd to me. You find these people, you know, like Batman in the Flathead Valley. Mike Gogan, you know, is so concerned about these kinds of children, missing and exploited children. Why are these people? Is it because they want to keep an eye on certain things and be able to, you know, make sure that they're managing the missing and exploited children? I don't know. But, you know, there was that piece, George Soros, Hillary Clinton, Haiti, you know, all that stuff. We're trying to help the children. We're bringing them back. Why are you shuttling them secretly and... Curious how these things happen. So the National Institutes of Health, Team Rubicon is another name. World Food Program, again. No. Curious customers. What is the other one? It's not just Promise. It's also H.B. Gary is the other interest that I'm thinking of. Speaking of Palantir, H.B. Gary. And Facebook and so forth. All right, so the extra, then to the phones. Page 53. The CIA is Wall Street and drug money is king. Okay? So, chapter 3. The CIA is Wall Street and drug money is king. Michael Rupert made this more plain than I think most had previously. Or at least in my estimation. I'm sure that there were others. But to me it was elucidated more plainly. The CIA is Wall Street, Rupert wrote. The CIA is Wall Street. Wall Street is the CIA. This is perhaps one of the easiest landmarks to establish on our map. We do it by looking at key players in the CIA's history and their relationship to America's financial regime. Not to mention Rowan Gaither's admission to Norman Dodd and curious clues like that. You know, Prescott Bush, Hamburg Steamline, Brown Brothers, et cetera, et cetera. Clark Gifford, the National Security Act of 1947 was written by Clark Gifford, a Democratic Party powerhouse, former Secretary of Defense, and one-time advisor to President Harry Truman. In the 1980s, as chairman of First America Bank shares, Clifford was instrumental in getting the corrupt CIA drug bank BCCI, founded by a Pakistani national, a license to operate on American shores. Remember, that was the CIA's money laundering front. That was the CIA's Iran-Contra bank, and at one point considered the seventh largest financial institution in the world in short order, in less than a decade. Continuing, his profession, Wall Street lawyer and banker. BCCI and its particular web of characters has been a virtual cut-and-paste overlay linking up Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and terrorist financing. It was Clark Clifford who was retained by former CIA Director Richard Helms when the latter was indicted and prosecuted for lying to Congress in 1976. This lying to Congress is a continual theme, speaking of Ollie North. Clifford and his banking partner, Robert Altman, were eventually indicted on criminal charges for their role in illegally helping BCCI purchase an American bank, First American Bank shares. At the time, BCCI had been connected to both drug money laundering and financial support for Afghan rebels, supported by the CIA through its director, Bill Casey, John Foster, and Alan Dulles. These two brothers, as Rupert used to say, Dull, Duller, and Dulles, these two brothers designed, quote-unquote, the CIA for Clifford. Both were active in intelligence operations during World War II. Alan Dulles had been America's top OSS spy in Switzerland, where he met frequently with Nazi leaders and looked after U.S. investments in Germany. He also held an executive position with Standard Oil. John Foster went on to become Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower, and Allen served as CIA Director under Ike. only to be fired by JFK after the abortive 1961 U.S.-led covert invasion of Cuba known as the Bay of Pigs, or maybe we call it Operation Zapata, I don't know. Their professions, partners in the most powerful to this day Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Enron is only one of Sullivan and Cromwell's current clients, and it employed a dozen former CIA officers before its fall from grace. Other prominent Sullivan and Cromwell clients are AIG, Global Crossing, IM Clone, Martha Stewart, and the Harvard Endowment. After the assassination of JFK in 1963, Alan Dulles became the staff director and lead investigator of the Warren Commission, which asserted that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. By the way, the term, just parenthetically, the term lone wolf seems to have sort of drifted away. Do people realize, maybe it's because bad guys realized, remember who the first lone wolf was? Wasn't it Chuck Norris? Lone Wolf McQuaid. I digress. The Warren Commission, which asserted that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin who had fired a bullet that had caused JFK's throat wound, hung suspended in midair for several seconds, changed direction twice, then wounded Texas Governor John Connally in the chest, wrist, and thigh, only to fall out of his body in nearly pristine condition on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital in Dallas about 30 minutes later. When asked about how he could have offered the Warren Report, full of consistencies, to the American people with a straight face, Dulles is reported to have said, quote, "The American people don't read." Bill Casey, Reagan's CIA director and the OSS veteran who served as chief covert wrangler during the Iran-Contra years, and again, speaking of Casey, I think of Barbara Honegger's words. Did CIA Director William Casey really say, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false," which confirms what Ralph McGahey wrote in Deadly Deceits back in 1983? Barbara Honegger says, "Yeah, actually." And it's interesting how that's just getting buried now as I look in things that disappear. Where is that even now? William Petroff, he's, you know, the authority on the discussion. Where is Barbara Honegger's? Did Barbara Honegger comment on this forum? Of course, probably not. Greg Smith studied at University of California, Santa Cruz, says, yeah, here is the email, Sunday, September 21, 2014. Speaking of the Warren Commission, the put-up job, William Casey, you know, the effort to deceive, the CIA memo on conspiracy theory and so forth. Nah, don't believe your lying eyes. Don't believe any of that stuff. Bill Casey, Reagan's CIA director and OSS veteran, who served as chief covert wrangler during the Iran-Contra years, was, under Richard Nixon, chairman of the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. His profession, Wall Street lawyer and stock trader. In 1984, ABC News was devoting serious attention to a CIA scandal in Hawaii connected to the investment firm BBRDW, Bishop, Baldwin, Ruwald, Dillingham, and Wong. The BBRDW story was lifting a veil connected to money laundering, drugs, and the failed CIA drug bank named Nugan Hand, which is another connection. By the way, Nugan Hand. Anyway, Bill Casey and the CIA's general counsel, Stanley Sporkin, put extreme pressure on both the network and anchor Peter Jennings to stop their coverage. During the semi-public battle, ABC's stock dropped from $67 to $59 a share, and by December, the firm Capital Cities was trying to buy the network. Capital Cities successfully completed the buyout of ABC in March of 1985, after which the CIA conveniently dropped a suit against the network. Bill Casey had helped to found Capital Cities and had served both as its lawyer and as a member of its board of directors in the years between his service as SEC chairman for Nixon and as director of the CIA for Reagan. ABC became known thereafter as the CIA network. Other sources including the family of the late Colonel Albert Vincent Caron, resident of Long Island, including the family of the late Colonel Albert Vincent Caron, about whom I have written extensively, Burt writes, confirmed that Casey was a lifelong resident of Long Island and that Caron, a made member of the Genovese crime family, retired NYPD detective and CIA operative, routinely exchanged insider trading information with Casey. Speaking of Martha Stewart and Sullivan and Cromwell, I digress. Multiple witnesses and, you know, a mule. I mean, what happens is somebody says, you know what, that's too far. I don't think I want to do that. I think, you know, my speculation is conjecture. What happens is someone says, nah, that's just too much. Oh, you know what? Guess what? I have tomorrow's headlines, and look at there. You are on trial for insider trading. Oh, how unfortunate for you. You sure it's too far? Maybe we should play that clip from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. They're smart. They take my advice. Stanley Sporkin. Sporkin served as the CIA's general counsel under Casey, but he had previously served for more than 20 years at the SEC, rising to the post of general counsel. Casey's right-hand man, he was one of the first people Casey brought in with him to the CIA in 1981. Almost all of Sporkin's tenure at the SEC was spent in the enforcement division, charged with prosecuting corporate and stock fraud, or, you know, maybe turning a blind eye to it, perhaps. During the Iran-Contra investigations, it was revealed that Sporkin had routine contact with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who was later convicted on several felony counts, including lying to Congress. At times, the emails between the two men alluding to the 1920s comedy team Laurel and Hardy read to Stanley from Ollie. After retiring as CIA general counsel in 1986, Sporkin was soon appointed U.S. District Court judge in Washington, D.C., where he presided over some of the most important trials, including Microsoft's, talked about that the other day, in the country. He resigned from the bench in January 2000 and joined the Wall Street law firm of Weil, Gotchel, and Mingus, self-describing as specializing in Wall Street management and capital. The firm is currently serving as Enron's bankruptcy counsel. Although Sporkin received praise for many of his decisions from anti-corporate critics such as Ralph Nader, he presided over a number of more nefarious cases, including that of former Federal Housing Commission Commissioner Catherine Austin Fitz, whose firm Hamilton Securities had been targeted for malicious and unfounded harassment after uncovering evidence of covert operations that tied the Department of Housing and Urban Development to drug operation slush funds, friendly Wall Street interests, and political corruption. Last, Fitz was the target of a 1996 Ketam whistleblowing lawsuit, which allows charges to be filed under seal for 60 days while the Department of Justice investigates whether this is there's merit to the case. As a result, Fitz was not allowed to know who had made allegations against her, or even what the allegations were. Sporkin extended that seal for 5 years, thereby turning a brief investigation period into a nightmare that prevented Fitz and her attorneys from being able to know or even address an accuser or his allegations. Sporkin was able to do this with no evidence of any wrongdoing, yet his decisions in the case routinely favored the unnamed parties seeking to discredit Fitz and upheld illegal actions by the federal government, including the seizure of her company offices, a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. There's more, but time won't permit. Anyway, there's much more. And this is the CIA. The CIA is Wall Street. Wall Street is the CIA. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, gang. Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
When you were here before, I couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You flow like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so very special. But I'm a
welcome back. Final segment of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast. It becomes clear when you have the multitude of evidence before you that the CIA is Wall Street, Wall Street is the CIA. There is a very tight nexus between those interests and these, you know, foundation, the interests that tower over these, the foundations in particular, and that were instrumental in creating the intelligence community. And in simple terms, the Federal Reserve System, the Department of the Treasury now, and the Pentagon, essentially, Department of Defense, are really just sort of slush funds, kind of like petty cash for the globetrotting efforts. And the devaluation of the dollar is really secondary to these kinds of interests. Because, you know, tyranny is expensive, and we can't underwrite these efforts without a lot of cash. Obviously, terrorist financing is expensive and so forth. Propaganda is expensive, as Bernays pointed out in the book Propaganda. And the CIA is instrumental in laundering efforts because, you know, you have the cloak of secrecy under the specious guise of national security. And so what a perfect ruse. And, you know, the evidence shows historically that episode after episode, this is what we're seeing. Despite what we're told and what we're, you know, the Jedi mind trick waving before our eyes. Anyway, to the phones in the final moments here. Harvey in Florida, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Chris. How are you doing today, man?
All right. What do you think? Have I painted an accurate picture to some extent? Oh, maybe not complete, but...
making me sick. To sum it up, is we're screwed. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
We are screwed. It's unbelievable. You know, if you want a list of all the foundations and the think tanks, what you have to do is listen to National Public Radio from one day, 24 hours straight, and you'll get a list. Congress is obviously bought off, paid off, because they could shut these suckers down and confiscate every dime they have within one day.
Yeah.
You get the list right off of NPR.
Yeah.
All the people that are guests on the show,
or PBS, or the Rand Corporation monographs, or Brookings, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, absolutely.
Council on Foreign Relations should be shut down. It could be done within 24 hours, and we could have our country back. But the people in Congress, well, just let me say this. Look at Mike Pompeo. He came from Congress. He was supposed to be on the committee to watch the CIA. Mm-hmm. Then he became the head. And now he's Trump's right hand.
And so it goes.
We're screwed.
Yeah.
But we could turn it around thanks to people like you broadcasting the truth. Thank you very much, Chris. I'll let you go.
Thank you, Harvey. Much appreciated. I agree with Renee Wormser in addition to what Harvey said. When they do harm, it can be immense harm. There is virtually no counterforce to oppose them. But we have the information. So I hope it was informative. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Cardiovascular system run like a Swiss watch. I definitely recommend this product for anyone that has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and heart palpitations, A+. It's potent, but it works. I have been waking up for the past 3 years with numb hands, and a week into using Extendivite, my numb hand seemed to have cleared up. My circulation was off, and now it's back on track. So I'm happy. I feel so energized, and I have my husband on it now. My mother-in-law has cholesterol problems, so I bought her a bottle as well. Thank you so much. Love the product. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.